Hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We also stream live at kuci.org. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher and all kinds of places. Today is Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest is Heather Young. Heather is the author of two novels. Her debut, The Lost Girls, won the Strand Award for Best First Novel and was nominated for an Edgar. A former antitrust and intellectual property litigator, she traded the legal world for the literary one and earned her MFA from the Bennington Writing Seminars in 2011. She lives in Mill Valley, California, where she writes, bikes, hikes, and reads books by other people that she wishes she had written. She's here to talk about her new novel, The Distant Dead, published by William Morrow. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Thank you, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to talk with you. I recall meeting you, we met March 12th, and I remember the day because we were both at Left Coast Crime, the annual conference. It was in San Diego, and I remember, you know, a lot of people backed out because, you know, the pandemic was beginning and what was going to happen, and some of us went anyway, and a few hours after we got there, they closed it down because there were too many people. And I think we met right before my driving friend and I left. So that was interesting.
That was an interesting night. It felt like it felt like the end and the beginning of something all at once. I had really wrestled with whether to come because I live in San Francisco, so I had to get on a plane to fly down. But the event was still on, and I thought, well, you know, I'll just go. I have a book out. I should be promoting it. So I went down there, and literally about 90 minutes after I got to the hotel, they shut the whole conference down.
Yeah, it's interesting. And we drove down from Orange County in a raging rainstorm. It rained the whole way. It was sort of the kind of rain that you'd turn back and go home. It's like, why aren't we going home? Because we have to go only to turn around and come home. But,
there was some great apocalyptic feeling.
Yeah, there were some great things that came out of it. And one of those things was that just before I left, I met you, and I think you handed me your book, unless Greta handed it to me. I can't remember.
It was probably me. I had brought down a bunch of ARCs to give out to people who wanted a book signed. And so then I just handed them out to everyone in the bar.
Well, I'm so glad you did. So let's begin with the inspiration for The Distant Dead. How did the novel come about?
Well, it's my second novel. And I had really struggled to come up with an idea for my first novel. I'm not a short story writer who has ideas percolating constantly in my head. It's a struggle for me to come up with a story idea. And I was a little worried that I might never get another story idea. But about a year from finishing my first novel, my family and I live in San Francisco. My parents live in Boise, Idaho. We would drive the kids, the golden retriever, the bikes on the back. We would drive across Nevada to Boise to see my parents. And one day on one of these trips, the gas station that we normally stopped at on Highway 80 was, the pumps were broken, and panic set in because we're in the middle of the desert. I don't think there's another town within 100 miles, but the gas station attendant says about, half a mile down the road, there's a town and they have a gas station in the town. So with great relief, we drove into the town to get gas, and the town just captured me. It looks quite blighted. It's a town without much character or charm. A lot of the original buildings have been replaced by more modern, less attractive buildings. And of course, the setting is just so barren. And I was fascinated by the fact that there seemed to be this thriving community out there in the middle of nowhere. So even though I didn't have a story idea yet, I knew that the next book I wrote would be set in that town. It just fascinated me, that town did.
And then the plot. How did the plot emerge from setting, or did it?
Well, it did with the first book, but this one, a friend of mine works for a company that curates documentary films, and she went up to Montana to be a judge in a documentary film contest. And when she came back, she told me about the film that won, or that she wanted to win. I don't remember if it won. And it was called Love and Terror on the Howling Plains of Nowhere. And it was a documentary about a math teacher, a university math teacher in a small town in Nebraska, teaching at the junior college. And his body was found outside the town, just burned to a crisp. And nobody knew what happened, and they still don't know what happened to him. And the documentary was about how the small town dealt with the mystery, and particularly the fact that this math teacher had moved there fairly recently, so not a lot was known about him. And both the fact that he'd been burned to death and the fact that he was a newcomer to a small town, I thought to myself, I'm going to take that idea, both those ideas, and transfer the story to Lovelock, which is the name of the little town where the distant dead is set. So then once I had that little germ of an idea, then I could build a plot around it.
Mm. Did you have to do a lot of research? I mean, did you feel like you had to know as much as possible about what happened to start your book, or was the germ of the idea or the germ of what happened enough?
It was enough. And in fact, I didn't really want to know more. I wanted to take it and really be able to fictionalize it. And I thought the more I knew about the Genesis story, the more it would maybe corrupt my own imagination. So I did watch the documentary, but there's also a book that was written. The documentary is based on a book, and I did not read the book because I did not want to get into that level of detail that I would feel obligated to honor that story. I really wanted the story to be my own. So that research I did not do, but I did end up spending quite a bit of time in the small town of Lovelock trying to get myself steeped in the setting and talk to some people who lived there, find out why they lived there, what they did there, how many generations their families had been there. So that kind of research into place I did over the course of a couple of years.
Hmm. And then in terms of the story and plot, are you a plotter or a pantser? How much did you need to know, and or was it a path of discovery for you as to what happened, or did you have the ending that you were writing toward?
A path of discovery. That would be a very nice way to put it. I kind of felt like it was walking through a dark forest with a flashlight that the batteries were dying. Mm. You can only see a few feet ahead of you, and you sort of grope your way to where you can then see a few more feet ahead of you. Didn't feel like a journey of discovery, but that's the way I write, I think. I do have a sense of an ending. In this case, I changed the ending a little bit when I got there, but I did know, generally speaking, what happened to the math teacher and how he ended up burned to death outside of this town of Lovelock. And so then it is a process of groping my way towards it with lots of fits and starts and wrong ways and having to backtrack and deleting entire subplots and adding more subplots. I do envy the people who can write from an outline. I have learned that I'm not going to be one of those people. I think I really need to just feel the story out as I go.
And there's a ton of arcane to me information about math in the book. It's like I learned quite a few things here. I think I missed that day in school. But so one of the characters, Mr. Merkel, one of the major characters, is a math instructor. How did that happen? How did you happen to make him this math expert and teacher?
Well, the original story from the documentary, the victim was a math teacher. I didn't have to keep that, but I kind of liked it. I made my character kind of a refugee. He had taught math at the university in Reno, and for various reasons that you find out during the story, he kind of flees to this little desert town and he teaches middle school. So, you know, quite a come down from, you know, a theoretical math professor at a major state university to go teach, you know, sixth graders about the rudiments of algebra. So that kind of intrigued me. And then, you know, years ago, I was listening to a Science Friday episode with Ira Flatow, and he was talking to a couple of math geniuses. And I am the opposite of a math genius. I mean, my math comprehension stops at geometry. And I had to take calculus in college, and I think I passed it by the skin of my teeth. It does not come naturally to me. So listening to these guys talk and realizing, and I think one of them even said this, math is a language that not everyone can understand. And when you understand it, it is a lens through which you see everything in the world. And that fascinated me because I can learn any human language that's verbal. I mean, I could probably teach myself or learn Urdu if I really apply myself, but I'm never going to learn the language of math. And so knowing that there are people who get this and who are so excited about the way the way the world looks when you're looking through it, I really wanted to play around with that. So I have another character in the book who is a math prodigy, and he talks about that. He talks about how math is really his way in, his access to the world, and everything comes through that portal to him. And so it was just a fascinating way for me to explore that kind of person who is so different from me.
I find it really surprising that you say math does not come naturally to you, because as I was reading, I'm thinking, my goodness, I mean, how are you like a novelist creating this wonderful crime story, and you also understand math? I don't understand how that is. So I find it really interesting that you say you just, you're not that math person that I was sure that you were.
No, not at all. I do like the concept of, and there's a lot of talk in the book about circles and the number pi, and mm-hmm. and how the circle is like the purest form in the universe and probably the original form. And so you can get kind of philosophical with math in that way. And I do get that. So I was able to talk about that, I think. Yeah. But any impression that anyone gets that I know a lot about math and understand it deeply, it's really just me faking you out. Sorry.
Yeah, well, you did. You did a good job of that. And I will also say there's not too much of it. It's not, right. There's not so much that your eyes glaze over as a reader. So I don't want to give that impression, but it was just math and chess. I think I came away thinking this writer knows a lot about math and chess.
Really, no, there, it is definitely not steeped in math, but the themes of math as a way to see the mm-hmm. world are definitely there.
Yeah. And, you know, you talked about setting a little while ago, and the setting in this book, it's so visceral and immediate. And you said you spent time in Lovelock. When you were there, or when you're dealing with setting, what are you doing? I mean, are you taking notes? Are you paying a lot of attention? Are you, you know, looking it up online to understand the place? I mean, how are you getting it down?
You know, it's a lot less true research than I expected. I hadn't done this before. With my first book, I based it on a place that I did know well. This was a different situation. I had to learn it. And I thought I would go down there and spend a lot of time in the library and learn about the history of the town. And I did try to do that one day, and I realized that just wasn't helping. What I really needed to do was experience the town. So there's a lot of photo taking. I took a lot of pictures on my phone and just, you know, put them in a big, you know, database or whatever to look at later. I walked out into the desert and like ran my fingers through the sand and took my shoes off and walked around in the sand. And I touched the leaves of the plants, and just really the tactile sensory experience of the place was important. And then I just talked to people. I would go out to dinner and go out to lunch, go to the local bar. And I, without telling people that I was researching for a book, I would just ask them chatty questions like, hey, did you grow up here? What's your favorite thing to do here? You know, and just try to get a sense of the people, and especially what they loved about it. Because even though my main character doesn't like her town and she really wishes she could leave, so there's a lot of negativity about the town that comes through in the narration, I did want to have that other perspective from other people who do love it there, and be honest about it. Because even though I wouldn't want to live in Lovelock, there clearly are people who love it there. So getting that sense from people about what they loved about their town was a big part of the research as well.
Yeah, and they're the brothers, Gideon and Ezra, who, you know, their family's been there, their ancestors were from there, and they're staying.
They are absolutely staying, yes. They're hunkered down, they're never leaving.
Did you find a lot of people like that when you were talking, that you know, who came from there, whose relatives came from there, and that's why they were staying?
that is pretty much the only reason why they're staying. Mm-hmm. I did not meet anyone who had moved there from anywhere else. Mm. I think it really is a place that has deep roots there. It was originally a stop on the California Trail back in the 1850s. And there are a lot of families that have been there since then. I talked to one bartender who said she married her high school sweetheart, which happens a lot to people there, and he joined the military. So they spent a few years traveling around to different military bases. And when he left his military career, I think after 4 years or so, they couldn't wait to get back to Lovelock. Hmm. They had been to some pretty exotic places, but they wanted to be back in Lovelock where they could raise their kids around people that knew them and they had community that could support them and that they could be a part of. So that was interesting to me that someone could leave, seed other options, and then still want to come back because of that call of family. And I will say both my parents are from small towns in Iowa and they left. They got married and they moved to DC and raised their kids. But we would go back and visit in the summer to see my grandparents. And I remember being deeply envious of that sense of community and connectedness that everyone in those towns had. And I was living in a suburban sprawl where we didn't have any relatives nearby and there wasn't even really a town center to speak of. It was just a bunch of subdivisions strung out along a road, a highway. And that small towns appeal to me that way, that is something really, really beautiful about them.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Heather Young. We're talking about The Distant Dead, published by William Morrow. So writing about a place you know versus a place you need to get to know, what are the differences and which do you prefer? Which are provide better fodder for fiction?
I think having done it each way, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I prefer one way or the other. I will say that I don't think I will use a real place by name in a future book. I found it very, I had a lot of kind of stress around like, am I portraying this accurately? Does this street really intersect that street? Uh-huh. Does this business really exist? And I felt a great need to be very accurate about the place because it's a real place and I'm calling it by name. And I had these fears that people would email me and say, that's totally ridiculous. There's no gas station at the corner of 4th and blah, blah, blah. So I didn't like that. I like the idea of rooting it in a real place, but giving myself the freedom to mess with it a little bit by maybe changing its name. So it's a fictionalized name and can be a fictional place, even though it's based on someplace real.
Yeah. I would imagine that the schools are fictional.
The schools are not fictional.
Uh-huh.
They're not fictional. And I went and probably looked like a gross stalker hanging out at the middle school, like watching people go in and out. And so they're real and I took pictures of them. So the descriptions of them are accurate.
Have you heard from any readers who said, you know, why did you do this and you got that wrong? Or are you not hearing from anybody?
Not yet. I think the book hasn't been out long enough. And mm-hmm. And I don't know, honestly, it may take a while to trickle down to people in Lovelock that I wrote a book about their town.
I'll be so interested. I'm very interested to hear if anybody gives you trouble about it.
Yeah, I think what I'm dreading happen and may happen is that I think people might be offended because I do portray the town through the eyes of my character who hates it in a negative light. It is an unattractive little blotch on the earth full of provincial stupid people. And she just mm-hmm. is too good for them and, you know, wants to get out. And probably if I lived and loved Lovelock, I might not like this book. Hmm. So I worry sometimes that I'll get an angry email from someone accusing me of slandering their hometown.
Right. Hmm. Well, I'd love to hear you read from
the okay. Yeah. Sure. All right. Okay. So I'm going to read you from an early chapter. And this is a scene where Sal, who's the young boy at the heart of the story, has just walked into the fire station in his little bitty town, which is fictional, by the way, and is up in the hills above Lovelock and is even smaller than Lovelock, if you can believe it. And he's just walked into the fire station and he's found Jake, who's the one volunteer on duty. I found a dead person, Sal said. Jake rocked forward. What? Sal's shoulders twitched as though he thought Jake was going to grab him. I found a dead body up the hill a ways. Holy shit. Jake stopped and got himself in hand. He was wearing the uniform of the Marzen Volunteer Fire Department, and he took that responsibility seriously. He turned off the television. Is it a skeleton? No one in Marzen was missing that he knew of, and every once in a while, somebody turned up the bones of a miner or a settler who'd taken a wrong turn on the way to California. Sal hesitated. No. Do you know who it is? The boy's dark eyes slid sideways to the station's narrow refrigerator. There was a sign taped to the door that warned of terrible consequences if food was left in there too long or if anybody took food that wasn't theirs. I think it might be my math teacher.
Your math teacher?
There's a car. I think it's his. Jake didn't know what to do. He looked around the small station for help, but of course there was none. Leon Petrelli wouldn't relieve him until 2. Maybe he should treat this as a medical call, he thought. Marzen was small enough that its fire department volunteers doubled as paramedics, and Jake was even more proud of his EMT license than he was of his fire department uniform. He could take the ambulance up there, see what Sal had found. He wiped his palms on his pants. Okay, why don't you show me? They drove up the dirt fire road that led from the town to the Prentice place. Jake figured Sal had found the body on his way to the school bus, and sure enough, about a mile along, they came upon an old brown Corolla parked just off the road, and Sal told him to stop. Jake walked over to the car. He knew better than to touch it, but he looked inside. It was empty. He walked back to where Sal waited beside the ambulance. All around them, the foothills of the Humboldt Range rose in bristly mounds, treeless and dry. To the right, the land sloped up toward a rocky cliff that threw man and boy into shadow. The wind pushed Sal's Denver Broncos sweatshirt against his thin chest. It was cold in this high desert country in March. The tops of the mountains were still white with snow. Sal turned and led Jake up the slope. They climbed in silence through sagebrush that snatched at their pant legs. When they reached the top, the ground dropped into a seasonal wash that ran along the base of the bluff. A cluster of acacia trees stood there, their canopies lifted to the sky like open palms. They were the only trees Jake had seen since they left Marzen, and the dense little grove spoke of shelter, of safety, of a place to hide. Sal stopped. The wind whipped in the sagebrush and the gray-green leaves of the acacias and moaned as it curled among the hills. There was a smell, too, faint but insistent, tangy, ripe, burnt. Far above, 2 chicken hawks floated in lazy circles, their wings tipping in, then out, then in again. Jake looked at the boy. His eyes were closed, his shoulders drawn in tight. Is it down there? Sal nodded without opening his eyes. Wait here. Jake pressed one hand against his belly, tucked in his shirt, and walked into the wash. When he reached the grove of trees, he didn't see the math teacher right away. He saw the careful ring of stones that made the fire pit and the ashes piled in the center. Around it lay trees that had grown and died and fallen, their corpses blackened in the long, quiet decay of desert things. At first, Jake took the math teacher's body for one of these. Only when he saw the empty vodka bottle and the children's jump rope did he see what was left of the man. Then Jake, too, closed his eyes.
Thank you so much. That was Heather Young reading from The Distant Dead. Oh, you know, I wanted to ask you about Sal and Nora and why you chose these two as point of view characters, narrators.
Well, Nora, she was kind of my, I guess she's sort of the avatar of the town. She's a youngish woman. She grew up there and she wanted to escape. So she did. She went off to the University of Nevada at Reno. She was going to major in anthropology and take that degree all around the world. But a tragic accident on the eve of her graduation pulls her back home. Her brother has been killed in an accident and her father was driving and her father was left pretty injured. So she needs to now take care of him. So she's stuck there. She is stuck in this town against her will, kind of trapped there by obligation and a certain feeling of guilt because of a promise she made to her mother that she ended up breaking by going to college that she feels contributed to this accident. So she was a good juxtaposition character for me to balance against the Adam Merkel character. he comes there looking for sanctuary. She really wants to leave. She doesn't think it's sanctuary at all. So she kind of sees him as the flip side of herself, and that makes her curious first about why he came and then about what happened to him. So she's the one who delves into the story kind of as the amateur sleuth, if you will, to try to figure out what happened. So she was necessary, obviously, to the story. Sal, though, I thought it would be interesting to have one of Mr. Merkel's students play a big role in the plot. And I also have to confess, I love writing characters that age, that 11, 12-year-old age. I have a couple of girls in my first book, The Lost Girls, are 11 and 13. It's just such a fraught period. And that whole coming of age story, those stories have always resonated with me. And I thought putting a boy there on the kind of at the outer sunset edge of childhood, on the cusp of something that's not quite adulthood, and then throwing him into this horrible situation with the teacher that he loves being murdered and he finds the body, just was really ripe for some narrative character juiciness. So he seemed like a good choice to throw in there as a character as well.
Yeah, interesting. And he comes to town with a tragedy, sort of a similar tragedy to Nora and her father.
Yeah, there's some definitely some echoes among the stories. Sal's mom has died about a year ago, and everyone thinks she died of a heart attack, but that's not actually how she died. And when she died, he's sent to live with his reclusive kind of prepper uncles who live on this kind of ranch up in the mountains where they live off the grid and hate everybody and distrust everybody and hunker down preparing for the end of days. And so, of course, he's miserable living up there with these two men who paid no attention to him, and he's already an outcast, and now he's even more of an outcast. Yeah, and yeah, so there's similarities between what he's going through and what Nora's going through, and I tend to like that in a book when people's stories kind of echo each other a little bit, because then you can really, really kind of develop themes that resonate, that kind of have that have tuning forks that pop up throughout the narrative that make them kind of vibrate.
Mm, yeah, that's interesting. And opioids abuse is one of the secondary themes. Was that purposeful?
It came up pretty early on, because as I researched the town, I learned that they do have quite a problem with opioid addiction. And of course, when I was beginning to write this book, it was 2017. And not that the opioid crisis is any less severe, but it was certainly very top of mind in the national discussion two or three years ago. And so I thought I wouldn't really be honest unless I infused something of that into this story. And then once I decided to do it, it really became a big part of the narrative drive. And I liked it. You see most of the opioid abuse and the business of selling illegal prescription drugs through the eyes of Sal. And I thought that was an interesting perspective to offer on the opioid crisis, how it is seen through the eyes of children.
Especially because he's not a user so much as helping his uncle.
Yes, his uncle, one of his uncles, has this kind of shifty, shady, down and dirty prescription drug business that is not a really sophisticated business. He just is using his dead mother's prescriptions at first and selling them. And then he kind of gets hooked up with a dealer from Reno. But he needs somebody to deliver the drugs because he lives up on this prepper ranch. But Sal takes the bus to school every day down in Lovelock, and the light bulb goes off and he says, "Hey, kid, you can deliver these to my customers." Mm-hmm. So he ends up kind of roping Sal in, kind of first against Sal's will, but later Sal becomes a little bit more complicit. And that was interesting to write too.
Hmm. Did you make Sal's town fictional because that's where a dead body is found?
I wanted him to be even more of an outcast than if he were in Lovelock. And so I thought, what if there's this other little town, the kind of the town that Lovelock looks down on? The people from this town are real hicks and hillbillies and get no respect from the more sophisticated big city folks in Lovelock. And so putting him up there and creating that town was kind of I liked that idea. And then of course too, I did need the body to be found somewhere, and I did need to have Sal conveniently find it. So it made sense to have the body found near this remote little town. Yeah. Yeah. And this is the sort of thing when you write blind, these are the ideas that come to you as you write. Oh gosh, I probably should have him live up in the hills. Okay. Let's read five chapters so that he lives up in the hills.
I go through that with my writing. It's like, can I put this in this town because the history of this town is so interesting that if I can't use this town, then I lose all the history. Whereas, right. Anyway.
Right. And I will say too that having Marzen be a total fictional town was really, really great. And because then I could just really play on my easel with all the paint colors and make it however I wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't do this. I almost did it with your book, but I've done this in the past where I look up towns and places to see if they're actual. And I'm kind of, I don't know. I come to a place where when I find out it was fictional, I'm like, well, I really want it to exist. I really want this place to be there. Why isn't it there?
Well, it seems like there should be a town there. I mean, it is right near the mine that I mentioned is an actual mine. Mm-hmm. And so, and there is also too, an old mining town up there that's now a ghost town. Mm. So in a sense, I was kind of recreating that town as though it had never, as though it had never died and people were still living there.
I wanted to also ask you about Sal. He's a fan of Neil Gaiman. And I wondered if you were as well.
I am a big fan of Neil Gaiman. Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I honestly can't remember how I got the idea to put that in there. Sal was a character who evolved quite a bit over time. In the beginning, he almost had superpowers in some of my early drafts. He was a kid who had, I don't know if I'm even using the right word, but synesthesia, mm-hmm. which is where you can look at someone and kind of see auras around their heads that represent their feelings. And I had him that kind of kid until my editor pointed out that was really, really, really lazy. And it was, and I was like, yeah, I don't have to explain to the reader or show the reader that a character is angry. I can just have Sal look at them and see a red aura around their head. So I took that out and made him just very deeply empathic instead. But I still wanted him to have kind of a supernatural kind of edge. And I've always loved The Graveyard Book, which is a classic Neil Gaiman kind of middle grade story about a young boy who's an orphan and he's taken in by the ghosts in this spooky old graveyard. And they protect him from someone who's trying to kill him and they raise him there. And only he can see the ghosts and only they give him kind of little powers like he can move among the living and they don't notice him because he's got the powers of the graveyard. And it seemed to me that Sal was the kind of kid who would read this book and just deeply empathize with that main character and maybe even convince himself that he has kind of those powers himself because he does move through the world unseen and unnoticed. And because he's deeply empathic, maybe it would be possible for him to be able to talk to the dead. And so once I got the idea, it really was something fun to run with. And it just really informed the plot. Like, what if you had this kind of kid and his mother's dead and all these other people in the book are dead? And what if he gets the idea that he could talk to them? And that, of course, goes very poorly for him, as it should in any book.
Yeah, sure does. Well, something else I found really interesting about your novel is that while it's a crime novel, very much so, it's also very much a literary novel. It's literary fiction. And I wonder, if you, in terms of writing it, if you had an idea for how you wanted it to be described after it was published, if you wanted it to be called, it's a crime novel, it's literary fiction, it's literary suspense. I mean, did you have any idea of where you wanted it to land?
That's a really great question. And it's one that I have struggled with all throughout my very brief career. I wrote my first book thinking it was literary fiction and thinking it would be that it's a family story about family secrets and how those secrets poison the lives of, the succeeding generations. But that book did have kind of at its core of the plot was what happened to a little girl who went missing in the 1930s. And so when the publisher, when they started marketing it, they started marketing it as a mystery, as a thriller, as a suspense, as psychological suspense, as domestic suspense. That wasn't how I'd written it, but I didn't, as it turned out, I didn't really mind it being portrayed that way because it, as it turns out, if you fit a book into a genre, it is easier to sell it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And I thought, well, maybe I'll take my next book and I'll try to stay in that lane, in that genre lane, and I'll have it revolve around another mysterious disappearance or death. And so I'm comfortable being in the mystery genre. It's definitely most of what I read anyway. But I'm not always comfortable with being only described as a mystery writer or a thriller writer or a suspense writer, because I think my books, like you say, they're not really quite that. And I do get comments from people who say, I expected this book to be something different because it was marketed as a thriller. Hmm. Or I expected it to be something different because it was marketed as domestic psychological suspense. And I think if you, that can be a problem. If somebody picks up a book expecting one thing and getting another, you run the risk that they're going to be disappointed. So I do struggle with how to describe my books. I guess I've kind of come down on the side of saying literary mystery. And mm-hmm. avoiding the thriller word entirely, because you would not call this book a thriller, I don't think. Yet they do.
Well, but the title and the cover kind of give you the feeling of what it is too.
Yeah, I think the cover does do a good job of evoking the book as maybe being more, I don't know, thought. I don't want to say thoughtful, but like more of a meditative, slower, not thrilling mystery. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense, something that's evocative of, you know, a book that's evocative of place and character, as opposed to plot, 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 turn the page, turn the page, turn the page.
Right. And William Morrow, I think I was a little surprised that this would be a thriller put out by William Morrow. So even the publisher gives me the sense that it's a literary suspense novel, you know?
Yeah. And honestly, I do know that now when they published my first book also. And of course I just was thrilled to get a publisher and I didn't know much about the different imprints. I agree with you now. Now that I see the other authors that they publish, I think I'm a little bit sideways on their brand. Not completely. I mean, they published Laura Lippman too. And I think she's mm-hmm. a terrific character-based, more literary mystery writer.
Yes.
So I think the umbrella is wide enough to fit me, but I'm definitely not kind of right down the middle of their brand.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that happens to be what I like so much to read is I don't know, novels that kind of span genres, you know, where the writing is important, there's character, there's some plot, you know, but I don't know, just to read for straight plot, it has just never quite been what I've been interested in. So
right, me neither. And I like, I mean, Erica Swiler is one of my favorite writers, and she's a total cross genre. You couldn't label her books if you tried. She's also a William Morrow author, and her books they're literary, but they're kind of also got this crazy science fiction element to them. Hmm. You can't pigeonhole her, and I really like writers like that. So I that's kind of what I aspire to be, is someone where you could say, yeah, there's elements of mystery, but it's also very character based. And in this book in particular, there's a little bit of a supernatural element. It's just a bit of it straddles several lanes, and I like that. And yeah. I like to read that, and I like to write that.
Yeah, I sure do too. So when you went to Bennington, were you writing literary fiction then? And did you find your way into crime writing there? And how was that? Because it does seem that most MFA programs really center around literary fiction without the crime aspect.
Yeah, that is very, very true. I don't know if you know Ivy Pakoda.
Yes, of course.
These women, yeah. So she and I graduated from Bennington together in the same class. And we have often talked since about how we just really went off the reservation in terms of going into this mystery, noir, thriller genre, because that's definitely not what they teach. they're very literary in the way that they teach and the books they have you read and the teachers who teach there. But I think learning how to write a great literary work is just a terrific platform and educational base to go in any direction from. So even though, yes, I think most MFA programs are pretty dialed into the literary, that's not a bad way to learn to write. And then you can change it up and ditch some of what you've learned to maybe fit a different kind of book. I, as for what I was writing when I went there, I wasn't writing anything. I had started to try to write a book, and I'd come up with the idea for The Lost Girls, and I'd gotten about 5 chapters in. And anybody who's written a novel, I think, has had this experience where the first 4 or 5 chapters are kind of easy to write, and then you hit this point where you've done all the setup, and you maybe kind of know the ending, but you've got another 200 pages to write in the middle. And I did not have a clue how to fill that vast wasteland of empty space. And I struggled with it for a year or so, rewriting those same 5 chapters and unable to write chapter 6. And finally, I thought, you know, a friend told me about these low residency MFA programs where you don't have to move. You can do it kind of long distance. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to apply to a couple of those because I think I might need some actual tutoring here, some teaching. So I went to Bennington. I applied with those like 3 of the first 5 pages that I'd written in my entire life. Those were my submission pages. So when I went there, I didn't have a long history of writing behind me at all. And I got, you know, I kind of devoted my time at Bennington to getting past chapter 5, which I did.
Go ahead.
And pretty much worked only on the novel while I was at Bennington.
Hmm. So do you recommend MFA programs?
You know, it really did help me. But it helped me in ways that not everybody would need necessarily. I needed structure. I needed deadlines. I needed somebody to make me do it. Mm-hmm. And having this program and for those who don't know, the way a low res program works is you go there twice a year for about a 10-day residency. And during those 10 days, you have intensive workshops and readings, and it's this total immersion into a writing world that's fantastic. And then you're assigned a teacher for the semester, and you send that teacher every month a packet, and the packet contains 25 to 35 pages of new writing of yours. And then in Bennington's case, you're also writing essays and critiques of books that you're reading. You're expected to read 5 books a month and write 2 to 5 page, you know, little mini dissertations on some element of craft that you're focusing on in that book. So these packets are big and they take a lot of time, but they also made me every month have to come up with 30 more pages. Mm-hmm. I needed that. I really did need that. And the other thing it gave me that, the writing community was fantastic, that just having that, because I didn't even know anybody really who was trying to write a book except for one other person when I went. So finding other people like me who were struggling kind of at a later age in life, because I was 44 when I went, was great. And then because they force you to read other books and they force you to read other books differently. I'm a prolific reader. I've read all my life for pleasure, but being directed to choose a list of 25 books every semester that you're choosing them for particular reasons. You're going to look at those books because let's say that semester you're trying to really dial deep into character development. So you and your teacher will choose 25 works of literature that are rich in character development. And you read those books, taking notes with that in mind. And so I learned literally at the feet of the masters by reading all their books. And so for me, that was a great way to learn. But I'm going to also say that there are plenty of people who do not need that structure, who already have a writing community and have maybe actually taken a creative writing course at some point in their lives, which I had not, and do not need the MFA program to get going. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag. It worked for me, but it's not necessary for everyone.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about the business of writing and agents and all that. And I think I read somewhere that you found your agent through submitting something to an agency and the slush pile and yep. There you go. Uh-huh.
Yep. I was a total slush pile submitter. It took me another 4 years after I got my MFA to finish my first novel. It was a 7-year process to finish that novel. And so there I was at the age of 48 with a book and no idea, you know, where to go with it. So I did a lot of research into how to write a query letter and how to submit. I did a lot of research into targeting agents. I think it's very important to do your homework and figure out which agents are interested in the kind of book you have. And there are some resources you can go to do that. Poets and Writers is a great resource. They have a database of agents that has all kinds of information, like what kind of books they like. So then you come up with, I called it the spreadsheet O agents, and it was like 120 agents. And I started querying them 10 at a time, just blindly, just slush pilely. And I was lucky. Karma does work in mysterious ways, because this is a terrible time to publish a book right now. I mean, the confluence of the pandemic and everything else that's going on, I am not having good karma with my publication date, but I had great karma with my agent query, because I sent my first batch of queries out on a Sunday night right before like one of the biggest blizzards in the history of the Northeast shut down New York City, and all the agents were stuck at home and they couldn't go to work and they couldn't have their lunches and they couldn't do anything. So Monday morning I woke up to 3 emails saying, I'm stuck here with my cat. And I opened my email and there's your query letter. Sounds kind of interesting. I'm looking for something to read. Will you send it to me? And that was just a matter of timing, because who knows when they get to their slush pile, but they were forced to look at their slush pile out of sheer boredom. So that was the karma that I'm balancing now with my horrible publication timing.
So was that in the first 10 that you sent out?
Yes, it was. Wow. I didn't ever have to query beyond those first 10.
And then how did you choose the agent you went with?
So there were, I talked to, I think, 5, and the first one to get back to me was the one I ended up going with. Mm-hmm. And her name is Michelle Brower, and she's absolutely fantastic. And when she told me she wanted to represent me, I had to kind of say, can you wait a couple weeks? Because I've got a couple of other agents reading the manuscript, and I feel like I owe it to everyone to let them read it and talk to them. And she's like, totally, totally get that. And then she proceeded to like send me books in the mail. And
she charmed you.
She totally courted me.
Yeah.
Everything I had read, and like, here's just an anecdote. Everything I had read about finding an agent said, find the agent who loves your book, who really loves your book. And I didn't really know what that meant until I got into it. But Michelle loved my book. And one of the other agents I was talking to, just as a contrast, in our conversation, she was basically saying, I can sell this book. There's a market for this book. I know editors who would like to buy this book. You know, there's an audience for this book. We'll label it as this and we'll sell it. It was a business transaction to her. My book was a commodity. There mm-hmm. was nothing about like, oh my gosh, I love this book. I'm really invested in this story. I want to bring this to the world. It was just like, yeah, I can sell this and make some money. Whereas Michelle was just very effusive about loving the book. And so you want that agent. If you have a choice, you want that agent.
Yeah. And then did she work with you? Is she one of the kind of, is she an agent that really likes to get into it and just work with the material until it's just absolutely perfect to send out, or how did that go?
She is one of those editorial agents. I will say after 7 years of working on this book, she didn't have a lot. There were some changes she suggested. And of course my editor suggested more, but I think it took about 6 weeks. She said, you know, tweak this, tweak that, you know, develop this character a little bit more, you know, maybe add a scene here that bridges these two plot points. And it was just a matter of a few weeks before she felt it was ready to go out. But she is, generally speaking, someone who's really willing to roll up her sleeves and get into the manuscript, which is great.
And then what happened when you got the publisher, editor, was there more tweaking and more, you know, add this, take this away?
Yes. That was kind of funny too, because when my agent took the book out, I then talked to some editors and I got every kind of feedback from all these different editors. And it kind of made me realize why it's so hard to sell a book these days, because it just, not everybody likes everything, and people like things for different reasons. I mean, in my first book, there were two interwoven narratives, one kind of in the present and one kind of in the past. And I had one editor tell me, oh, I love the story in the past, but you're going to have to totally rewrite the story in the present. And another editor said, oh my gosh, I love the story in the present, but you're going to have to totally rewrite that past story. It's just not working. And then one person said, I think both stories are working great, but I think we need a serial killer in the woods who appears like every six decades to kill more people. So I was really glad to have found my one editor who was like, yeah, I get this. I think you just need to tighten it up, and you know, you need some more misdirects and things like that. But she wasn't going to wholesale make me rewrite the whole thing.
Yeah.
But it was amazing how different editors reading the same book had completely different reactions to it.
And it's so obvious why writers become so confused, because everybody's telling you something different.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
Did it come down to what you felt in your gut was the story and what you wanted to stay with? Or did your agent support you in finding the right editor who, you know, said, tighten it up. You don't need to do all this other stuff.
Yeah, it was, my agent was very supportive throughout that process. And, you know, we hung up with the one person who wanted there to be a serial killer. And she's like, no, you're not going with that editor. You're not putting a serial killer in this book. But there's also, when you talk to someone who's offering suggestions on your book, you know, you can tell if those suggestions resonate with you. And when Kate Ninsel, who's my editor at William Morrow, was talking about what she wanted to see changed in the book, every time she said something, I was like, oh, yes, that will make the book better.
Sure.
Oh, you are completely right. That absolutely needs to happen. So when their suggestions are things that you just get in your gut, are working with the story you want to tell, then that's a good fit.
Mm. You know, because the first book and this one are more considered to be in the crime genre, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Can you also talk about the difference between, or what you perceive the difference between the literary fiction community and the crime writing community? Because it does seem that there's a lot more support for crime writers, mystery writers, suspense writers, than there is for literary fiction, writers of literary fiction.
I think there may be something to that. I can't really speak to the literary community other than my MFA program. And of course, those people were an incredibly supportive group of people because I went through that process with them. But one of the reasons why, when my publisher kind of marketed the book as a mystery and started suggesting that I go to places like VoucherCon and Thriller Fest and Left Coast Crime, and I did, I realized that yes, the mystery writing, thriller writing community is fantastic, very supportive of each other, fun, creative, interesting people. I mean, I kind of was like, I want to stay in this club. This club is a good club. And I didn't ever really I haven't ever been to a purely literary writers conference. I can't really speak to whether that, how it is in that world, but it certainly is extremely welcoming and supportive in the thriller mystery. It just seems like everyone's having so much fun writing what they write. Mm-hmm. And it's just, their enthusiasm is catching.
Yeah. I wonder why it doesn't seem to be the same way for literary fiction. There's, you know, there are conferences and residencies and such, but not the same sort of community. It's just puzzling, really.
It may just be that it's just a broader and more diverse coalition of writers. Mm-hmm. I mean, literary is just really broad. You can be writing literary, historical, and it maybe there's just not that connection around, it's just too broad a category to encourage that type of community. Mm. But again, I don't know.
Yeah. We have a few minutes left, and I wonder if in the few minutes we have left, you have any advice for the writers who are listening, who are maybe battling their way through a novel?
Yeah. Well, speaking as someone who took a really, really long time to get through writing her first novel, there was something I read somewhere along the way, and I think it was probably in Poets and Writers, that only about 4% of people who start to write a novel actually finish that novel, like get to the where they type the end. 4%. There's a lot of half-written novels in people's desk drawers. And so it's a struggle to get to be one of those 4%. And the difference between those who finish the novel and those who don't is simply that the people who finish it stay in the chair and finish it. It's not that they're better writers. It's not that they're gifted in any particular way. They just keep at it. And so my advice to anyone who's struggling to write a novel is just keep at it. Get in the chair every day for at least a few minutes, and time will pass and words will go onto the page, and eventually you will get to where you're typing the end.
Wonderful words. The end. Yes. Unfortunately, we're at the end, and I so appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. Thank you so much.
So much fun for me. Thank you so much for having me. Yes. And I hope we see each other at Left Coast Crime next year.
Next year. It's Albuquerque, Santa Fe, somewhere out there.
Somewhere out there, yeah.
Yeah. Well, continued good luck with The Distant Dead. You've received great reviews thus far, and I pray they continue. And see you soon.
Okay. Thank you so much, Barbara.
You're welcome.